Good afternoon, church. Happy Sabbath to wherever you may be watching from today. I hope that you have been blessed by what we've shared so far, and I hope that you get some encouragement out of this message. Before I dig in today, I just want to encourage you to pray with each other and pray for each other. I know that we can't physically meet right now, but you know that doesn't stop us from picking up the phone and calling someone or getting on Zoom, but I want to encourage you. Find a friend, find someone from church that can be a prayer buddy of yours if you don't already have one. And pray with each other, pray for each other, and most importantly, just pray during this time because I think that is so important in the situation we're in right now. I just want to reflect on a bit of scripture that has been encouraging to me during this time and during this moment. But before I get there, I just want to lay some groundwork. It's going to sound bad first, but I promise I'm going to get to the good stuff. But I want to ask a question. Do you know what the leading cause of death for people 45 and under was last year? Have a think, maybe even Google it. What do you think the leading cause of death was last year for people aged under 45? It wasn't COVID. It wasn't cancer or heart disease, which usually tops the list. The top leading cause of death was suicide. Death by self-harm has been on the rise for several years now, and many doctors actually use the term epidemic, but it was accelerated to new heights in 2020 and now even into 2021. People are in pain. We are in pain. Think about all the pain that has endured the last year and even into this year. To start, we had fires, we had floods, economic meltdown, a pandemic, racism, political instability, unrest, growing divide between the left and the right. I could go on and on and on. And all of it has a cascading effect on us. It has been a year, and it still continues to be a year of intense pain. On top of the heavy weight of personal tragedy that many of us have lived through, disease, death of a loved one, economic troubles, we're also caught in the middle of a political holy war between the left and the right. And you only have to look as far as America, but we're starting to see it here as well, that this is a winner-take-all battle, even to the death at times. I came across this quote by an African-American essayist, and he had this insight. He said, "I imagine one of the reasons people cling to their hate so stubbornly is because they sense once hate is gone, they will be forced to deal with the pain." What an insight. Behind hate, behind the fever pitch of outrage culture, behind the ranting and raving on social media from one tribe against another tribe, is a country and a world in which we are all dealing with pain. Yet psychologists warn us to distinguish between pain and suffering. Usually we use them interchangeably, but they are two different terms. Pain, what is pain? Pain is what it is. A global pandemic, the loss of a business, the death of a loved one, the fracture of American politics, the move to a post-truth society. That is pain. While suffering is our response to what it is. It is the meaning we make, or the meaning we don't make, of our pain. It's our emotional reaction. It's our body's way of first holding and then finding a healthy or toxic way to discharge or to deal with the pain. Not yet. And a lot of people, the result of suffering is trauma, a kind of deep emotional wound we carry in our body, a toxic memory that lives on in our body's unconscious, sabotaging its inner humanity against the many diseases that threaten our soul's life. In the mid-90s, there were these two psychologists, Richard Tedarchi and Lawrence Colhorn. They developed a concept called post-traumatic growth. The basic idea is this. Some people seem to grow as a result of trauma. They come out on the other side of a painful experience, not just okay, but better, stronger, deeper, more refined as a person. He put it like this. People develop new understandings of themselves, the world they live in, how they relate to each other, the kind of future they might have, and a better understanding of how to live. They went on to create the post-traumatic growth inventory, which was an attempt to measure people's pain and the effect it had in five different areas. And they said this. These are the five areas that we could potentially grow in during times of suffering and how we can grow. Appreciation of life, relationships with others, new possibilities in life, personal strength, spiritual change. In a time of pain or suffering, all five of these areas are rife with potential for growth and expansion of our soul, of our inner being. COVID-19 and the chaos that it has ensured literally has the potential to make or to break us, to produce trauma or post-traumatic growth. Most of it has to do with our response and our relationships. We don't know how much longer this pandemic and the accompanying social unrest will last. We're also hoping, 2021, we hoped that we would be back to normal and we tasted it. We thought we were there, but yet we are back here. Clearly that is yet to happen. So here is my question. How do we not just survive the coming season? How do we not just survive the next coming months, the next coming year? But how do we come out the other side stronger with a better appreciation for life, for relationships, and for new possibilities? How do we grow our soul? How do we grow our relationship with Christ? How do we become more and more formed into that image? Is there a way to deal with this suffering with joy? Can we do it well? What do the scriptures have to say? And a text that always speaks to me, one that always encourages me, and I've reflected on it before and I want to reflect on it again just from a different angle today, it comes from the book of James. So let's hear from James. I'm going to be reading from James chapter 1. James, who was the brother of Jesus and one of the many figures in the New Testament who was very familiar with pain and suffering. James's words come to us from a personal experience and a person with spiritual authority. And so let me just read the text, James chapter 1, verses 1 to 4. If you don't have your Bible there, it's on the screen. James, a servant of God and the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes scattered among the nations, greetings. Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, when you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. And so allow me to just reflect on this text. Most scholars date James's letter to around 65 AD, right after a wave of persecution scattered the church all over the Mediterranean. The gospel that God had made, the crucified Jesus, both Lord and Messiah, was a threat to the powers at be. It was a threat to Roman society and to the corrupt Jewish temple. And so they reacted with violence. Followers of Jesus faced a bitter decision: run from the government crackdown or die. In fact, the word scattered is the same word used in Acts chapter 8. And this is what it says in Acts chapter 8. On that day, a great persecution broke out against the church in Jerusalem, and all except the apostles were scattered throughout Judea and Samaria. Those who have been scattered preached the word wherever they went. Thankfully, we in the West are not facing persecution in the true sense of the word. It's still legal to preach and to share about Jesus, at least for now. Yet there are a few parallels between James's original audience and to us modern readers. James is writing a letter to the church because they are no longer able to meet in person. In a pre-digital world, a letter was the best option. In a similar way, we are not together as a church physically, yet we can still learn from the letter of James here today. James is writing to a church that is facing trials, not just one trial, but trials of many kinds, multiple, and these have a compound effect. And he is writing to a church that is most likely, if you read the subtext, a very sad church. If you can relate at all to this scenario, James' opening is full of wisdom that is more than worth our time and attention. And so I'm just going to go through it line by line and just reflect on this text. Verse 2 opens with consider. It can also be translated as count it all joy. It means, do the math, add up the facts, calculate the sum total. The idea James is getting across is this. Run a mathematical calculation on your trials. Sort the data into a loss column and a profit column. If you value what God values, and that's a large sum if many of us do it, you will realize the result of trials is often a net profit. We gain more than we lose. Trials have more to offer us than what we will lose from them. I don't know about you, but I label most of 2020 and now a bit of 2021 as a loss. My sufferings has been minor compared to some others that I know, but we've all lost something this past year, and we've all lost stuff this year. Some people have lost those that they love. Some people have lost jobs. Some have lost businesses. Some have lost dreams. Plans have gone belly up, especially if you were wanting to travel. Opportunities are gone forever. Freedoms have been taken away. The ability to gather as a church or just to sit around a table with family or friends. With so much lost, it's easy to forget how much is in the gain column. Namely, I think the growth of a deeper and wider and stronger soul. A character that will last this life and the one to come. And this is a thought that I have. Trials have the potential to give more than they take away. James is saying, do the mental spreadsheet. There's more profit than there is loss. Therefore, follow his thinking here. The logical emotion is joy. Throw a party, invite all your friends to join on Zoom, but still, celebrate God's work within us. Please note, he's not saying we are to have joy in spite of our trials, but because of them. More specifically, because what are they doing in us? So let's keep going. Consider it pure joy. Pure joy. Not mixed joy, not one part joy, three part sorrow, but pure joy. Joy. The joy James is getting at here is a far cry from the Western pursuit of happiness or the idea that our happiness feelings are based solely on our circumstance. It's joy that, while not aloof or unaffected by circumstance, goes beyond the circumstance. It does not require our external world to be okay in order for our internal world to be okay. It's the kind of joy that says, despite what's going on around me, it's okay within me. It's a joy that can only come from one source, God himself, grounding us in all reality. You know, Jesus himself said that my joy may be in you and so that your joy may be complete. A preacher from Chicago, he said this about this passage. God has a corresponding joy for every trial we find ourselves in. The joy that we have, the world did not give it to us, and the world cannot take it away. Circumstances did not give us this joy, so circumstances cannot take it away. God has a joy that defines our trials. Or a famous musician, Bono, once called joy an act of defiance. Joy is an act of defiance. Joy is a rebellion against the counter-trinity of Satan, sin, and death. And what does James want us to apply with this act of defiance? He continues in this text, whenever you face trials of many kinds, whenever you face trials of many kind. And notice that it's a when you face, not if you face. Trials will come. Trials happen and will constantly happen in our life. Thomas Szasz, based on his years as a therapist serving those in deep pain, wrote this. The simplest and most ancient of human truths is this, namely that life is an odious and tragic struggle. That what we call sanity, what we mean by not being schizophrenic, has a great deal to do with competence earned by struggling for excellence with compassion, hard won by confronting conflict and with modesty and patience, acquired through silence and suffering. Job, the archetype of suffering in the Old Testament, was much more concise. Job said, "Man is born to trouble as sparks fly upward." Or in the language of Jesus himself, he said, "In this world, you will have trouble." In a world still suffering under the weight of human and demonic sin, trouble is the rule, while ease is the exception to the rule. This sounds harsh, but the acceptance of the fact that life is hard is not only the path to wisdom, but it's the path to joy. As M. Scott Peake writes on the opening page of The Road Less Traveled, "When you expect life to be easy, it is very hard. But when you expect it to be hard, an ironic twist happens. Life is very good." Whenever you face trials of many kind, James writes. The word face here can also be translated as fall into or trip over. It's a word picture that James is giving us here. Imagine you're walking along and everything is sunny, but then you trip over a crack in the pavement. One minute you're humming along with the birds, the next you're falling through the air, rethinking your health insurance plan. One Greek lexicon defines it as to experience somewhat suddenly that which is difficult or bad. The past year is a great example. You don't plan to lose your job. You don't plan to get sick. You don't plan for your things to fail. We fall into it. It suddenly happens. The word many literally means multicolored. Other translations have it as various kinds. Major struggles, major trials, minor struggles. There's going to be a political, personal, economic, emotional. You can go list all the different trials that we will face. We don't plan for them to happen. We fall into them. The word refers to the various trials that make up life this side of Eden. From a car breaking down, to waking up with a little niggle in the neck, to the tragic death of a friend or family member, to various diseases, or to a violent mob protesting somewhere, and everything in between. Think about what James is saying. Whenever we stumble and fall into various kinds of trials, trials that are not in our 5-year plan, trials that we hate and cause us deep pain, consider it pure joy. Many of us thinking, myself included, why in the world would I do that? How in the world could I consider that pure joy? But James, he already anticipates that question. He already has that response in mind, and he says, because you know, in verse 3, because you know. And this word know, it's not head knowledge, but a personal experience, a relational knowledge. The way you might know your spouse, or the way you might know your best friend, or the way you know that restaurant that you love, or the way you know God. Because you know that the testing, the word testing here means to try to learn the genuineness of something by examination and testing, often through actual use. This test, it's not referring to the kind of test you take in high school or in uni where you get the right or wrong answer. It's closer to the way that we might test drive a car, or we might test a product. We want to know, does it have what it takes? Is it genuine? Is it what the marketers said about this Toyota? Is it living up to the standard? To test, does it actually have the capacity to do what the maker says it has the capacity to do? Or is it just hype and digital spin? What a field test is to an off-road vehicle, trials are to us, disciples of Jesus. A test of what? A test of your faith. The word faith here is pistis. And a lot of English speakers confuse the word faith with the word belief. They don't realize that pistis can either be translated as faith or faithfulness. Some argue a better English translation is the word allegiance. Belief has to do with your level of trust and reliance on God. Faith has to do with how long you can hold on and trust that reliance on God through trials, through seasons of pain and suffering. When you feel like God has abandoned you or the cost of allegiance is too great to bear. Faith in God is faithfulness to God, no matter the cost. no matter what comes. That's what is being put to the test right now, our faith. Do we trust Jesus enough to stay faithful to him, to his way, to his teachings, to his church through 2021 and beyond? Or will we quit? Will we give up? Will we give in to what the world has to offer us? And so James writes that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. The word perseverance is hupotome in Greek. And depending on what your translation of the Bible you have there, it can be translated as perseverance or endurance or steadfastness. One lexicon defines it as the capacity to continue to bear up under difficult circumstances. Perseverance, it's a kind of emotional resilience, an inner strength of will, a capacity to live and love when the wind of circumstance is against you, to continue under pressure. But it's not just a grinding it out for Jesus and itching a permanent scowl into your face. It comes with the buoyancy of hope. We think of hope as being about the future, and hope is for the future, but hope is also now for the present. I define hope as the expectation of coming good based on the person and promise of God himself. Hope is kind of emotional energy to live well in the present in light of what's coming in the future. That's what trials have the potential to produce in us, a hopeful energy to keep on going even when it's hard. James ends his intro. And these four verses here are just an intro. The rest of James's letter is amazing, but this intro has a strong exhortation for those in a season of trouble. It says, let perseverance finish its work. I love how Eugene Peterson writes it in The Message. He says, don't try to get out of anything prematurely, as in before you mature. Let perseverance finish its works so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. Perseverance through trouble has the potential to develop in us a rich blend of emotional maturity and spiritual life to point where love and joy become our true nature, where we actually become godly or godlike. That's the end goal of discipleship. To become like the God that we love. To become like Jesus himself. And the word complete, it means whole. Hence the next line. Another play on words, not lacking anything. The idea is that prior to our various trials, we are deficient in something. But our pain and our suffering has not subtracted that. In fact, it adds to us. Now we are whole, we are well developed, we are more mature in our faith and in our relationship with God. Maturity is not the result of reading a lot of books or listening to a lot of podcasts or mastering self-help techniques. Maturity is the result of a long obedience in the same direction. But here's the key. The lifelong journey doesn't have to be an emotional sludge. We can persevere with joy. Of course, this isn't a norm. Take an emotional poll of all your friends. Very few people are happy about the onslaught of a global pandemic. The only people who are probably happy are the shareholders of Zoom. What cause of joy do we have? Why should we be joyful when the rest of the world isn't? And three things that we can learn from this text and from this reading is one, we are not alone. We are part of the family of God. Who is to consider it pure joy according to this text? We are, because we're in the family. We're in it together. In the opening line, it says, consider it pure joy, my brothers and my sisters. That's me, that's you, that's us, that's the family of God. Even the word you here in this text is plural in the Greek. Think about that, the implications of a plural experience of suffering versus a singular one. This past year has been traumatic for so many. But psychologists tell us trauma is what happens when people experience suffering alone. Trauma is not just about the level of intensity in suffering, i.e. when people experience suffering that is above and beyond the normal aches and pains of life. Many people live through extraordinary pain, a global pandemic, an unexpected death of a loved one, the gruesome death of a fellow soldier in battle, and come out the other side of it strong and healthy. Trauma also needs to take into consideration the level of isolation. We need a relationship. We need to feel safe and open up to each other, to let our soul bleed before another. We need another that we can hold our pain with. In Galatians, it reminds us to bear your burdens with each other. We are the family of God. We are meant to be in this together. Many years ago, a social psychologist conducted the first large-scale study of trauma survivors. His goal was to determine why some people experience suffering and are devastated, and others experience but seem to not only come out through it, but they come out better. They come out more joyful, come out with more ease than ever before. This guy, his name's James Penny Baker, and his hypothesis was that trauma for which there is a social stigma is harder to recover from than other forms of trauma. For example, he and his team researched sexual assault and the suicide of a spouse, two forms of trauma where they anticipated people would feel shame. But they discovered their hypothesis was completely wrong. There was zero correlation between the nature of the trauma and the potential for recovery. It turned out the number one factor in recovery was whether or not a person had family or a friend or some kind of emotional support group to talk about and process the pain with. What people need is a relational home. And those who had a relational home were mostly spared any long-term negative effects. And if I'm reading James here and the New Testament authors correctly, they are calling us as followers of Jesus to be that relational home for one another. They envision the church as a family, not a perfect community by any means, but one where we suffer through the world of sin together, where we come together to banish loneliness from our hearts and hold each other's pain in love. For a growing number of Christians, especially us in this westernized, individualistic world, the church is far from a relational home. And it's because sometimes the church acts more like a concert than a family dinner. And I think we need to get church being more of a family dinner and less like a concert at times. But the church failing to live up to Jesus' vision of family and relational home is not a new problem. It's been happening for years, centuries even. Read the New Testament. Most of the one another commands, for example, love one another, bear with one another, forgive one another, all assume relational toxicity, not health. They had to be reminded time and time and time again. You're in this together. Act like a family. Be together. Jesus and Paul and all the New Testament authors continue to call the church to live out their identity as brothers and sisters. And their emphasis is not on what the church should be, but what we should be. So when the church let us down, as it regularly does, the invitation is not to disengage and to write it off, but to re-engage with greater commitment. We must be for another what we desire them to be for us. A relational home. Can we be that relational home for each other? So I encourage you to find a prayer partner, someone you can pray for and with during this time. The essential fact of discipleship is that we cannot follow Jesus alone. Jesus designed the church as the relational home where we persevere through pain and suffering together. So one, we are not alone. We are part of the family of God. Two, as a family of God, we live by a whole other vision for life. The joy he's writing about does not make a lot of sense unless you're a follower of Jesus. Not because we're any better than those that we're surrounded by, but because we live by a different worldview and a system of meaning that our secular culture does not have. In his book, Walking with God Through Pain and Suffering, New York pastor Timothy Keller has a great summary of various worldviews. He has Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, etc., and how they deal with pain and suffering. He makes a very compelling case that the secular Western world is the least equipped to deal with any kind of loss and disappointment because it has no meaning to offer. The soil of secularism does not provide the nutrients required to persevere through something like a global pandemic, social isolation, and social unrest, because they can't attach any meaning to it. In a Darwinian materialist worldview, there is no meaning or purpose to life beyond the survival of the fittest. Life just is, a glorious or not so glorious, depending on where you live, how you were born. It's a cosmic coincidence to them. But as followers of Jesus, we live with a whole other vision for the meaning of life. A vision received from Jesus himself, not from within ourselves. It reveals the deepest desires of our heart. And in Jesus' vision of the meaning of life, suffering is rich, not only with meaning, but with the potential to launch us into an even greater experience of life. For us, followers of Jesus, life is a school of love. Not love in the modern sense of desire or even affection and affinity, but what Jesus calls agape, a willing of good towards another, no matter the cost to yourself. Inside a secular worldview, suffering has little to no meaning. See, if happiness is the meaning of life, at best, suffering is an interruption to the real goal of living. If not, in the case of a problem we can't fix, like death or a disease, suffering is a permanent obstacle. A popular magazine wrote this last year, 2020, everyone is struggling with mental health. Here's our guide to finding peace. The article was full of practical advice on finding peace. A lot of great ideas, mindfulness, therapy, lemon juice for breakfast, doing yoga on grass, all that sort of stuff. Being from Portland, they also encourage eating psychedelic mushrooms and eating mac and cheese at 2 a.m. But there is nothing in this article about finding meaning or purpose in our pain. Nothing about growing as a person through the difficulties. No mention of leaning into community, coming together or growing deeper in relationships. Nothing to do with that. Yet for Christians, suffering has a great deal to teach us. Suffering is rich, not only with meaning, but with the potential to launch us into something greater. That is why the Apostle James calls us to do a little math. There's a little saying in business that what gets measured gets valued, which means that if we value happy, problem-free life where we feel chronically happy, then the last year has been a very big disappointment, if not a colossal disaster. But if what we value most is becoming a person of love, a person of agape through union with Jesus, then 2020 and 2021 has been the great opportunity many of us have ever had to grow and mature into a new level of possibility. Finally, James offers one last reason for joy. God is at work in our pain to give us far more than we lose. In my view, suffering is rarely, if ever, from God, but it is always almost used by God. And it does this deep work within us. Notice the language again in verse 4. Let perseverance finish its work in you. The language is passive, not active. Growing into maturity is less something we do and more something we let God do through our trials. Our part is to not give up and to let God have his way in us. So how do we grow to maturity? By suffering lovingly. The primary effect of our suffering on our walk with Christ is to set us free from attachments. And by attachments, I mean the things we think we need to live a happy life, or our emotional programs for happiness, or what the Bible constantly calls time and time again, idols. We all have idols. Suffering has a way of not only revealing our attachments, but of stripping them away and setting us free. For example, if our happiness is attached to our job or our income or our health or our relationship status, then when it's stripped away, it's emotionally excruciating, a kind of psycho-spiritual torture. But if we release the illusion of control and consent to God's work through our grief and loss, we are set free. Because our attachments are what hold us back from life in God. This is why Jesus said it's so hard for the rich to enter the kingdom. Not because wealth and a happy life are bad, they aren't, but because very few of us can live with them and not need them. These gifts can quickly become our gods. This historic moment right here, right now, has potential to set us free from our attachments. But for that to happen, we have to consent to allowing God to work deeply within us. And there's no right way to do this per se. For me, it was carving out a few hours during the week, spending time wrestling with God, wrestling with scripture, and writing where I feel God was leading me during this time. And here's a few things that I feel God is leading me in this season. A deeper sense of trust during not only this season, but the seasons to come. Emotional resilience as a leader. It's hard to lead, especially at a time like this. Purity of motivation for ministry, not about my ego, but for love for people. Less of my plans and my ideas, and more of God's during this time. Contentment in the here and now. Content in what I have and in where I am, and not looking to where other people are at, but to enjoy this moment right now. And I'm sure that there is more that God is trying to do that I am unaware of. But if I were to come out of this pandemic with a new emotional resilience, an ease and peace when things don't go as planned, a motivation of love for all I do, full of hope and content within, that would be far more gain than loss in my life. I would have no other choice to count it all up, to look back and to count it as joy. To turn it around and ask you a few questions. What is God trying to do in you? Where is God calling you up to a new level of maturity? What attachments is God revealing in your heart? What are you losing? What could you gain in its place? Can you identify what God is trying to work in your soul? Can you give God not just consent, but cooperation? Take a moment right now and see if you can identify God's invitation. So what does James tell us? He says, consider it pure joy. Let perseverance finish its work and stay together. Here's one last thought. James' call to perseverance with joy under trial is based on our apprenticeship to his older brother, Jesus, who did the same for us in love. Listen to the passage from Hebrews 12, where the author uses the same Greek word as James for perseverance. Therefore, since we have surrounded by such a great cloud of witness, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith. For the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. Endure hardship as discipline. No discipline seems pleasant in the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. Different author, same call. Persevere, endure, don't give up, and do it together. There's joy to be had in times of suffering and pain. But the writer of Hebrew in this passage adds a new motivation. Because Jesus has already endured hardship for us. He endured controversy, rejection, slander and persecution, and finally arrest and imprisonment on false charges, and a corrupt court with a rigged jury and torture and humiliation, and in the end, death by crucifixion. All for the joy that was set before him. What is the joy that Hebrews is referring to here? Most scholars interpret joy set before him to be us. If that's correct interpretation, then James is saying that Jesus persevered through the pain of the cross for the joy of life with us. Therefore, see the logic here. We are to persevere through our times of pain and suffering for the joy set before us. And what is our joy? It's him. It's always been him. And so may you find joy this coming season in the midst of all the uncertainty, in the midst of pain, in the midst of suffering, in the midst of trial, grow. Grow deeply in his love. Grow deeply in developing your character, become more and more like him. So I leave with those thoughts. Let me just pray over you. Jesus, we come before you today just to seek you and to seek your presence. There's a lot going on right now, a lot that we're not sure about, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of trouble. But I just pray for each and every person, each and every family member, each and every person watching, each and every person from this church. May we come to experience the joy that you have set before us. May we be able to not only survive but thrive during this time because we're hanging on to you, because we're clinging on to the words of hope that you have for us. And so I just pray, may we experience your grace each and every day. May we experience your love each and every day. May we grow in our understanding for that love, and may we share that with others. So whatever the trial, whatever the challenge we may be going through, may we look solely to you and know that this isn't it, that there is more that you have for us. So I pray all this in your name, Jesus. Keep us safe this week. Keep us in your love and help us to share that with others. In your name I pray. Amen.